Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. James Ellroy's crime novel latest is Widespread Panic. It plumbs the depths of the 1950s Hollywood underground, inspired by a real-world figure from L.A.'s past, Fred Otash. Freddie Otash was a real person, a corrupt cop-turned-strongman who lived in Los Angeles in the 1950s. Ellroy has been interested in Otash's story for years, even got to know him in the years leading up to Freddie's death. Now, in his new novel, Ellroy writes Freddie's fictional confession, a story that takes readers through a fictionalized version of Otash's life and crimes. James Ellroy was born in Los Angeles. He's the author of the Underworld USA trilogy, including American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and Blood's a Rover, as well as the L.A. Quartet novels, which include The Black Dahlia and White Jazz. Again, the new novel is Widespread Panic, and it is a great pleasure to welcome James Ellroy back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Joe. What's shaking, daddy-o?
It is always good to talk to you, and I'm really excited because this book is so much fun. It is a really comedic, amazing read, but I have to tell you, it is there isn't a likable person in it, really, and yet you make them weirdly likable.
Well, Freddie's lovable in the book, his love interest. The esteemed television actress, Broadway actress, Lois Nettleton,
yep,
frankly a big fixation of mine, going back to the first time I saw her on the Naked City TV show back in the early 60s when I was 13. She's lovable. Chief Parker is oddly lovable. The Hat Squad, a couple of Freddie's sidekicks, a disc jockey, Nasty Nat Denkins, and a fool kid named Robbie Manier are likable. But these filmic people, particularly James Dean, who I've never been able to tolerate. He was a bad human being in real life, a crappy actor, and the overblown auteur, Nicholas Ray, the director of the overblown Turkey, Rebel Without a Cause. Well, they get some rough treatment from Freddie.
Now, one of the things that you are a master of is you are writing about real-life characters, and you are telling a fictional story. And you beautifully let us decide or conjure or maybe not even want us to think about what is real and what is not.
Right.
It's almost impossible not to do it in some way, and you're thinking, does Liberace really have this large cat in his house? But I don't know. But man, it all seems to make sense. It all seems to follow through. Nothing comes off as ludicrous as it sounds. It comes off as completely plausible.
Well, A, that's a great compliment, and B, it's all justified by the wild-ass place that was L.A., my smog-bound fatherland, back in the 1950s. It's the pre-internet era, thank God. It's pre-infantile internet. And sin, as in the sexual foibles of the Hollywood crowd and sicko socialites and putzo politicians, it had some pop. It had some panache. People were capable of shame. And Freddie was a dirt digger for Confidential magazine. He was the man that verified the stories with his army of goons and his gay bathhouses hotwired 24 hours a day, his hotel suites where nefarious bellhops lured sicko celebs to special rooms because they were audially recorded so that Freddie might get the goods on them and tattle it in Confidential. Well, it was all undercover, and I've uncovered it. And the one question I never answer about these historical books of mine is what's real and what's not.
And that works for you, I would assume, because A, it gives you, I would think, would give you more freedom, but also it makes it more fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And fiction should not be overly spelled out. And there's a rule, there's a law in writing historical fiction. Don't show your established historical characters in previously established real-life context. We, in American Tableau and the Colt 6000, you don't need to see or hear JFK's inaugural address.
Right.
You don't need to see Martin Luther King give his I Have a Dream speech in August of 63. Better to show them with some fictional characters in fictional contexts, and don't tell the reader what's real and what's not.
James Elroy is our guest in this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Widespread Panic. Let me just say that at the beginning of this novel, you begin in what you refer to as pervert purgatory in 2020. So we are hearing the confession of Freddie Otash going back to 1953. He's been in purgatory for quite a while.
Yeah, pretty crapped out in 92. And he's still paying for his misdeeds while on Earth.
And what I find interesting, without giving away the ending, but you don't really go back to that purgatory idea, which gives me the idea that you're not done with this character.
No. There's a slight wrap-up at the very end of the book, but I'm going to write a second Otash novel. I'm writing it now.
Now, what I find fascinating is the language, of course, this feast of language that you have presented us with. The thing I can't get over it, James, is just the stamina of it. It never lets off the gas. You never let off the gas. It is, from the second we engage, that voice is present, and it is screaming at us. You feel exhausted reading it. I can only imagine what it was like for you to write it.
It was a piece of work. It's difficult, alliterating, but I've written alliteratively before,
yeah.
And this is my greatest refinement of that style. You know, it's a very complex plot that we have here. It borrows from real-life contexts, real-life motion picture production. The notorious rapist, Carol Chessman, who went to the gas chamber at San Quentin Prison in May of 1960. But it's funny, and it's lewdly funny, and I was having a blast writing this book.
So when you write the story that follows, as you're writing the story that follows, is that Otash language the same, or will it be dramatically different, as it so often is in your work?
It's dramatically different because this is the tragic Otash coming up. He's a different character in the L.A., in the Underworld USA trilogy books, American Tableau, The Colt 6000, and Blood's a Rover. He's a comedic voice in his own book that we're talking about now, Widespread Panic, and in the next book, he'll be something yet even more different.
You invented this language. I mean, it's very L.A., it's very of the time, but you invented it.
I've taken alliteration to new heights or new depths. It was a snarky language that occasionally employed alliteration in Confidential Magazine and the other scandal rags. I've used scandal language in my books, L.A. Confidential, and some short stories written from the viewpoint of a scandal rag provocateur named Danny Getchell. But this is the one complete full-length book in that style.
I don't know if it is possible, and I don't want to put undue pressure on you, but is it possible for you to read just a small section to give the audience an understanding of the type of language that we're talking about?
Yeah, Joe, let me snag a copy of the book off a shelf over here. Give me 2 seconds.
Sure.
Okay, let me see. From the first chapter of this, purgatory is shitsville. You're stuck with the body you had on Earth when you died. You eat nothing but coach class airplane food. There's no booze, no jazzy intrigue, no Wiltshire Will women. Violated victims bought by my cell. They remind me of my many misdeeds and jab me with red-hot pokers. Gay gauchos hurtle down from heaven and scold me for outing them back in the homo hate 50s. Yeah, but it was my job. I entrapped soiled celebrities and putzo politicians, and I cornholed them in confidential. I sold my soul to that maladroit magazine, and now I am sordidly sorry.
That's a wonderful example. I love in the book, there's words like sorry, long, bad, where the vowels are extended. And you can hear your voice growling as you read it, which is terrific.
I got a good reading voice, but I'm only good at reading narrative because I can't differentiate dialogue. I can't be different characters. I'm not an actor.
James Elroy is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Widespread Panic, and it is published by Knopf. I came across this word so often when used to describe so many aspects of your work, that you are obsessed with the 1950s, that you are possessed by JFK. Is that fair? Do you feel it as an obsession?
Yeah, I'm quite an obsessive guy, obsessed with L.A. in the 40s, 50s, the early 60s, obsessed with certain of the real-life characters. I've been intermittently obsessed with Lois Nettleton since I first saw her in The Naked City back in 61. A lot of these big political figures I'm obsessed with. I'm besotted by Robert F. Kennedy. Yeah, I feel a great affection and respect for him that I don't feel for his big brother, Jack, or Edward M. Kennedy, for that matter. I live obsessively, and I write obsessively, and I want readers to read me obsessively. So I am passing the gift and the curse of obsession on to them.
What is the definition of reading you obsessively? How do you imagine that?
Ideally, given how dense the language is in these books,
yes,
and how big they are, Widespread Panic is not a long book. It's 320 pages. But routinely, my books are almost 700 pages, a quarter of a million words. And they're very, very densely structured with a lot of overlapping police investigations and love stories. It aids readers in their comprehension of my work if they read the book in fewer, longer, rather than many shorter sittings. I'm trying to get them hooked on the crack cocaine, the liquid methamphetamine of the prose, the historical context, and the characters themselves.
It also allows you to really think, because sometimes I have to go through it a couple times to understand what you're saying. It's not hard, but it's just because it is so fast and because it is such a feast, you do to fully experience it, have to look and say, oh, okay, that's what that is.
That's another compliment. These books are diagrammed, outlined, programmed to within an inch of their life, or perhaps I should say my life. I know everything well in advance of actually writing the text of the book. And I want a story that moves rich language, certainly. Gratuitous language, never.
What do you consider gratuitous?
Unnecessary physical description. I loved Ross McDonald's book when I was a younger man, but the depictions of flora and fauna and foliage and the names of flowers, there's always too much of it. I think Raymond Chandler and his flowery style bites the big brush hole. What I like telling the reader is what the people are doing, what they're saying, and setting the scenes as pithily and briefly as I possibly can.
You write in subjective third person. How did you come to that, and especially to refine it, bringing it back to Widespread Panic, to refine it in this way with these very specific characters?
One set of eyes per chapter, rotating chapters, three or four viewpoints for a subjective third person. Even though I'm saying he and she for the person whose viewpoint we're in during those specific chapters, we're in their thoughts, we're in their soul, we're in their mind. The actual style of the book shifts on this rotating three or four viewpoint basis. And then you go to books like Widespread Panic, which are in the first person. So we're just in Freddy's tortured noggin for the whole ride.
Many, I guess, would probably look at your books and say you're writing about a time in the 1950s where what you described was happened and was accepted and probably still is happened and often still is accepted, and yet we are becoming more aware. So the political correctness of it, are you ever concerned that you get painted with that, that that is who you are because these are the characters you are writing about?
I don't care, Joe. People have to make the distinction that fiction is fiction. Some characters may reflect the author's viewpoint, and most of them don't.
And I wouldn't think you could do what you do if you did care.
Nah. Is Freddie, early on in the book, talks about language, scandal language, and he says it's the thrill of the threat, the slithering slur. Language must lambaste and lay on the lash. I love words. I love all of it.
Does it, when you are in the process, as you say, these are outlined to the nth degree, once you are in that, does it come easily to you, or is every sentence a puzzle and a struggle in some way?
I wouldn't go so far to call it a puzzle or a struggle, but I'm very exacting, and it has to sound perfect.
Yeah.
I have expanded my style to enhance the emotional content of the books over the years. In fact, all of them, the cutoff point is the extremely abbreviated style of my book, The Cold 6000, my meditation on the madness of the American 1960s, and the subsequent three big novels, Blood's a Rover, Perfidia, and This Storm, are an expanded style. And Widespread Panic is an expanded, alliterative, first-person style.
Where do you feel your place is in the canon of crime fiction?
I think I'm the greatest crime writer who ever lived, period. America and the world.
And You're not exaggerating on that.
No, I'm exaggerating. That's the consensus in Britain and Europe. It will never be the consensus in America. I'm too brash. The books are too big. They're actually incomprehensible to a great many people. They're too difficult. They're long. They have 12 and 14 plot lines routinely, and a great many of the characters are very hard to like. It's very evolved language. But the artistry of my books supersedes the artistry of all today, all other crime writers, and everyone who came before me.
Well, and that
I am to crime fiction what Beethoven is to music.
Okay, so there's.
And if you don't believe it, Joe, ask me.
All right.
Yeah,
so
I do believe it.
You bring up two really important points. First of all, I love crime fiction. I enjoy. I know.
I
love reading crime fiction, but it is a formulaic style. There are people who do it brilliantly, and yet it follows paint by the numbers. That isn't you. You take it completely different. And I said this before, I'll say it again. No one has the stamina to be able to write at the pace that you do and for us to follow along. I understand what you're saying about it being difficult, but that's the pleasure of reading it, is that it engages your mind to go into so many different areas. So in some ways, I think it's almost unfair to compare your work to other crime fiction writers because, well, it's so different and so like out of the class.
I would probably say that the living crime writer that I admire the most, he's probably 3 or 4 years older than I, is Thomas Harris.
Yes.
But the Thomas Harris who wrote Red Dragon, I'm rereading it for the 5th or 6th time right now. It's got things that are wrong with it. It goes on too long, and it gets silly at the end. And Mr. Harris would be the first to tell you, and the great Mr. Harris, that Hannibal Lecter and Francis Dolarhyde are preposterous characters, that serial psychopaths don't do what they do. But he has created a level of Baroque evil and materialistic evil that's astounding to me. And the early part of Red Dragon, it's the greatest pure thriller that I've ever read. And the only manhunt, one man versus another man story that I think in the end is truly artful.
You have said that the most important thing for people to understand your work is the first line in your biography, which is on the flap of the book, which is James Ellroy was born in Los Angeles in 1948.
Yeah.
That is who you are. And we should note, 10 years later, your mother is killed. It is an unsolved murder that brings you into crime. But it also brings you into crime fiction, which gives you a lineage that I think really cannot be matched in the sense because you've lived this.
It's a traumatic influence, and it's one that directly came about because I tried in an inchoate 10-year-old's child's way to deal with the horrific event, and it was too painful in its real life incarnation, so I seized upon a fictional surrogate for my mother, and you know who it was. It was Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia.
Right.
And Elizabeth Short, it's the most famous, most celebrated unsolved crime, unsolved murder in America, certainly perhaps even in the world, and it is horrific, the details of it, much more so than my mother's case. Nevertheless, that's the fictional and factual lodestone for me. And all of this evolved in part because I wanted to be happy and fulfilled in this lifetime. And even as a 10-year-old boy, I had a stern will, and nothing was going to take me down.
So as a 12-year-old boy, you're sitting in school, you have a teacher who introduces you to Beethoven, who you just mentioned. And that changes you as well.
Yeah, the man's name was Alan Himes. For the life of me, I tend to believe that he's probably, may rest in peace, no longer with us. I hope he is. He was probably 35 in 1960.
Yeah.
But yeah, he put the stylus down on recording of Beethoven's symphony, dun, 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 and I haven't been the same since.
Because there was a power and a fury of that that you seemed to have wanted to internalize in a literature sense.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah. Later on, I formalized it and said, you know, I want to be the Beethoven of the crime novel.
Well, yeah.
I realized, well, Elroy, you better damn well work hard for the rest of your life. Huh?
Which, taking it to the final degree of that, to me, I find that these are so musical. This novel is, this is a symphony.
Yes, it's. A good friend of mine, a great cultural mind, a man named Grant Niebel, said that American Tabloid is my Bruckner novel, Bloods of Rover is my Mahler novel, and that Widespread Panic is my Shostakovich novel, because Shostakovich took us into modernism and beautiful, beautiful lyricism and horrific sound effects and dissonance. So I think Grant's right there.
The name of the new book is Widespread Panic. The author is James Elroy and the publisher is Knopf. James Elroy, it's always a great pleasure to have you on this program. It's a treat to speak with you and to talk about your wonderful work.
Thank you, brother, and Godspeed.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.